This time, World Cup greats, how Algeria were robbed in 1982, Brazil taken in turns to give an exhibition in 1970, and how on earth did Wales qualify in 1958?
No, nay, never. No, nay, never, no more. Cause I'll stay a while to over. Forever and more. And it's no, nay, never. No, nay, never, no more. Cause I'll stay a while to over. Forever and more.
Hello and welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a football podcast in which we talk through who the greatest football teams of all time are. My name's Graham Dunn. I'm joined as ever by Jamie Rooney. Hi, Jamie.
Hello, Graham. Again, good to see you. How have you been?
And in the guest chair. Yeah, good. Yeah, no. Strolling through, watching football, enjoying the return of Champions League football. But, you know, modern day football versus, you know, classic, especially classic World Cup stuff. Does it compare? I don't know.
I am very excited about the main event today, Brazil 1970. So I'm looking forward to that one.
And joining us in the guest chair this week, Scott Samanthal. And Scott, no doubt licking your wounds from a glorious Liverpool performance. It doesn't matter when people are listening in to this, because I don't think anything's going to change.
Thanks for it's great to see you again, David, and thanks, Jamie, for the invite, and thanks for throwing that one in. Appreciate that. That makes me feel even more rubbish than I did before I got the super sub invite.
Good to have you on board this week.
It is good to have you on board again, Scott. We absolutely enjoy your company. We think you're perfect for this forum, and maybe we can make it a more regular thing. I think let's just get into it. Algeria 82, that's our number one start today. Graham, I think you're going to lead on this one.
Algeria 82, and I love this story because actually it is a story about it's sort of twofold. It's a story about you know, a team which is barely known. I mean, if you tell people Algeria 1982, loads of people have no idea who they are, because, you know, they arguably have been amongst the most robbed of any team of the accolade and credit they deserve. And it, for those who don't immediately know what the story, of course, is the disgrace of Gijon. I'm not very good on my Spanish cities, but it is the Austria-Germany game in which the two sides played out. One of the dullest games ever, a 1-0 victory for Germany, thus allowing Germany and Austria to qualify and Algeria not to. You know, that in itself is already enough, but that Algeria side was, you know, to put it into context, that was the first, you know, African football at that point was still barely on the radar. That was the first World Cup that they had two African teams in the tournament. And it was only the previous World Cup that Tunisia became the first African team ever to win a game in the World Cup, I think. Before that, probably, Jamie, they were most famous for Zaire's performance appearance in 1974. And not to spoil a different one, we're going to talk about that. That does sort of say a bit about African football and World Cups at that stage.
Yeah, indeed. Zaire 74 is going to be a good one. There's a lot of stuff that goes on that, when we've done some research on that we can bring to light. But yeah, for the moment, you're absolutely right. It's Algeria 82. It is an absolute scandal what they had to suffer through a couple of European giants at the time, and I think it marked the birth of African football in the World Cup, because as you said, they were the first time. This is the first time that two teams had been allowed to participate in the World Cup, and that they literally was allowed to participate, because before that it was a very European dominated tournament. And Cameroon were the other team, and not to spoil any plot lines, but Cameroon actually drew all of their games in their group, which included Italy, who actually won the bloody thing, and Poland, who came third in the whole thing. So I think Algeria 82, is a great story, and I think it's the birth of the Africans arriving in the World Cup and going on to do great things.
And I think what, you know, one of the, it's also worth putting in context that it wasn't just a birth of African football. It was pretty much a birth of Algerian football too. They hadn't really done anything. I think they had, obviously it's the first World Cup, 1982 first World Cup they ever qualified for. They'd appeared in African Nations Cup, I think, at the start of the 60s, and then successfully not got in any more for the next two decades. And then suddenly you have this era of Algerian football, which actually then goes on to be sort of a golden generation, relatively speaking. They qualified for the 1986 World Cup. They win the African Nations Cup in 1990. It's the period where they're probably their most famous player of the era, Lakhdar Belumi, who was kind of African Footballer of the Year in 1982, still the most capped Algerian footballer at this time, perhaps probably overtaken by some sort of more modern day names now, household names, thanks to the Premiership, because of course, you know, Algerian footballers at the time weren't getting much exposure. But so Algeria themselves weren't there, and then their first game, who should they play? West Germany. So there they are, West Germany, and this, you know, they win that game 2-1, and that is a shock, you know, on a par with North Korea, Italy, right through to Saudi Arabia, Argentina, I guess. Unbelievable result to get to beat West Germany, who were a relentlessly efficient team at that stage, I guess you'd say.
They were really disrespectful to Algeria in the build-up to that game as well, weren't they? They were literally writing them off. And even before they'd kicked a ball, they were talking about the fact that they were going to beat Algeria 7-0 and they were going to celebrate each goal in honour of their wives. And it was outrageous the way that they were behaving. I mean, you don't expect a Germany team. I mean, we certainly don't. Now, maybe this is the reason why, but you know, you don't expect a Germany team to not be prepared. And they didn't even watch any video footage of Algeria before the game. And Algeria had a number of really great performances in the build up to that World Cup, a number of really, really good performances, and they should take credit for that and their performance against Germany. And I love this. This whole story is a really sad story, in effect, because this team got robbed of going through by, you know, the disgraceful behaviour of Austria and Germany. And it's a real shame, because how far could they have got? We'll never know, obviously. And but, you know, how honourable were the Algerians, not just in the build-up to the World Cup, in the way that they were playing football and embracing football in the style of play, but also having been knocked out, having beaten Germany and then got knocked out because of this disgrace in Dijon, they actually took it. They actually, you know, were really honourable afterwards, and just, you know, you've got to love that. I think it's a fantastic story, but it's such a shame that, the Germans and the Austrians behaved like they did.
It absolutely is. Even the setup to it is interesting, you know. And like I say, Algeria beat West Germany, extraordinary shock. They then lose to Austria in the next game. Austria had beaten Chile, the other side in the group. West Germany also beat. So you know, approaching the last round of games, you've got Austria, you know, 4 points. You obviously only 2 points for a win there, so two wins. West Germany and Algeria with 2 points, and then Chile right at the bottom. So Algeria then play Chile, who they beat 3-2, but they're actually 3-0 up at half time. At half time, they race into a 3-0 lead, even without their star player Belumi. And at that point, if the game finishes, then you know the whole Germany Austria thing can't happen, because you know, they would have to, you know, that was it. So they end up going into the final game with either a 1 or 2-0 win for Germany, meaning that both Germany and Austria qualify. But But, you know, that would be a 4-0, you know, a 4 or a 5, a 3 or 4-0 win, which totally changes the dynamic of the game. And you almost certainly wouldn't have seen it. Now, of course, that was, you know, and we'll talk in a minute about the Austria-Germany part of it, but that was the game that ended this not having final games played simultaneously, which arguably FIFA should have learned the lesson from the slightly dubious Argentina 6-0 win against Peru 4 years earlier, which
78, yeah.
which is probably was more overtly scandalous, I think. So Austria and Germany, and I don't know if either of you see her. I remember watching the game at the time. It was a very long time ago. I've seen bits of footage. I couldn't bring myself to watch the whole thing again. But Germany, obviously, you know, there's Germany need the win, so they absolutely go for it straight off, get their goal within 10 minutes. The most German-sounding player ever, Horst Hubesch gets the goal. Very impressive. Could only play for Germany, I think. They get the goal. And then, you know, as I'm reading about it, this is where the narrative kind of shifts a little bit, because you know, Germany then over the next, West Germany for the next sort of rest of that half, to some extent or another, still go on the attack to try and get the goal. And it's really only the point to which you get to the second half where the game starts to, would it be fair to say, flatline a little? some of the stats for it are extraordinary, aren't they?
I think, Graham, it's after the first 10 minutes, to be honest with you. From what I understand of the game, the Germany scored within the first 10 minutes. And then after that, they started, the whole press went out of the game completely.
Mm.
You know, none of the players were looking to try and tackle each other. And then, you know, by the second half, it just became, apparently all the players were just passing between the two teams amongst themselves, as if they were having a practice match. And it just shows the how toothless UEFA are as well, doesn't it? I mean, they're even FIFA, toothless.
I mean, UEFA as well.
Well, yeah, FIFA. Sorry, it's a World Cup, isn't it? We're not talking about the European Cup anymore. But how feefless FIFA were to just like let both those clubs, you know, those teams go through.
There was a protest after the game, but nothing. It didn't go anywhere, I think. And as you rightly say, Graham, the only thing that FIFA did at the time was to bring in the rule change where the final games of the group we played simultaneously in that particular next World Cup in 1986.
Yeah, so I mean, some of the, to your point, some of the stats are, especially in the second half, there's something like, I'd quite like the full Opta thing on it, but there's something like a 98, both sides had a 98 to 99% successful pass completion rate in their own halves. So they just weren't dispossessed. It was this weird, but slightly weirdly, the memo didn't fully get through. There's an Austrian player gets booked for dissent. He's obviously got wound up enough about it. I was watching an interview with Hans Krankl, the kind of Austria's legendary striker at the time, and he was there's absolutely, you know, there was no grief, you know, and. Who knows? So in that second half, there were three shots in the second half, none of which were on target. And so, you know, that certainly supports the idea that there was a conspiracy attached to this. But, you know, anyone, for example, who's watched Tottenham this year, it's absolutely possible to only have three shots in one half and none of them be on target. So, I mean, where do you draw the line?
The other thing we're forgetting about this whole game and this whole World Cup is it's another England what if. Because I don't know if you remember, we got Germany in the second group stages,
mm-hmm.
having won our first three games.
Well, that's the thing, Scott.
We drew with Germany and drew with Spain 0-0 and went out to Germany because Germany beat Spain 2-1.
Yeah,
so they progressed to the semi-final. Yeah.
But that's the thing with this game, this collusion that's going on, and there's absolutely no doubt about it. It's collusion going on between West Germany and Austria.
Oh, absolutely.
When Austria won 0 down, the result suits Austria better because they're now finishing second in the group, where previously they'd been top in the group with Algeria in second place, I think, at the time. And now it's going second in the group. The way the World Cup was then, 24 teams, and you went from one group phase into another group phase, a smaller group phase of three teams in the next round. And Austria were going to land in a group with France, who had finished runners-up to England in their group, and Northern Ireland, who were fantastic in 82. Norman Whiteside, Jerry Armstrong against Spain, fantastic. But, I mean, if you're looking at it, and you're an Austrian, who you gonna, you know, France and Northern Ireland, you fancy your chances more over England and Spain, which is pretty much where they'd gone if they'd won the group.
I think one of the really interesting things about it is then putting yourself in the position of Austria. Austria in particular, you know, I think Germany, once they got their goal and they're qualified, they're sort of that's fine, that suits them. You know, they obviously a second would help. But for Austria, who, you know, there is a bit of rivalry between Austria and Germany, and there's some shared history. And, you know, 4 years earlier, Austria, at the 1978 World Cup, Austria had beaten Germany 3-2. Hans Krankl gets two goals. This the first time they've beaten Germany in, like, 50 years or something. An unbelievable result. Result which is set up as it's called the Miracle of Cordoba, and it goes down in Austria legendary status. Yet 4 years later, they play the same team, and that game goes down in legendary status only as the disgrace to Dijon or whatever it is. My pronunciation is awful. But why, when you try and find the equivalent, it is like England playing Scotland, and you just couldn't imagine Scotland not being up for it, not wanting to put a tackle.
Yeah, agree. Absolutely.
I mean, Austria could have won the group. You know, they could have had bragging rights. It just, I just don't know how it wouldn't be wired into them, especially having, you know, the emotions of having had that game 4 years previous. I just don't know how they could go on that pitch and be so sort of kind of meek.
The sad thing is it feels like it was premeditated. So you wonder how deep. Because a lot of what I've read about it talks about the collusion between the players. Because it sounds almost like some of the reports sort of talk about the fact that, you know, both teams realised that scoreline would be perfect for the pair of them. And I can't believe that it doesn't go deeper than that. The collusion must have been at a much higher level, manager level at Germany, Austria, FA level. You know, there's the collusion and the corruptness in this game is beyond just the players. It goes a lot deeper than that, which is the sad thing about it, really.
It is disgraceful.
It is disgraceful. I mean, it is disgraceful.
I can't imagine playing any game where there's an element of competition and you don't want to win. I just, and football in particular, I can't recall any game of football, even meaningless like five-a-sides I've been part of, where I just want to win. And I'm playing against my mates.
We've had that, Jamie, haven't we?
I've fallen out with many people on a football pitch, mostly you, but yeah.
Graham, Jamie accused me of elbowing him in a five-a-side and like took
full umbrage. He's a dirty player.
This is unbelievable. I tackled him, right, and my arm just caught his nose. But, you know, Jamie's nose is obviously felt a lot of pain.
It's a big nose, I'll give
and,
you that.
And I went to apologise because I felt his head on my arm, so I realised what happened. So I turned around and Jamie's like gone for me, and that's then got my heckles up, and I've gone for him, and we've literally got to be pulled apart by a load of our friends who are playing five-a-side.
Fantastic.
That's funny. That's so funny. What a great day. But you're right, Jamie. I mean, you want to play to win. That's part of the sport, and that's part of the feeling, you know, certainly that I had at, you know, not even amateur level, at Sunday league, Saturday league football level. It was just, you want to win. You go on the pitch and you want to win, and there's nothing that beats that feeling when you do.
There's the reaction in the stadium, of course, from the fans who are out there, you know, a lot of... Who were angry, the reaction of football commentators, you know, across the board, various ones telling people to watch. There's one commentator who...
Turn over to the other side.
One commentator, I gather, refused to commentate on the last 5 minutes and left silence. My favourite reaction.
Maybe he was on a conspiracy.
the Spanish local paper gave it, which was to print the match report in the crime section of their paper.
Brilliant.
Crimes against Algeria. Getting back to Algeria, it really is a crime against them, because, as you rightly pointed out at the top of this, you know, an exciting new team has been denied the possibility of creating a different slice of history, an important slice of history. And, you know, I mean, as it turned out, Morocco in the 86 World Cup went and qualified. They topped the group that included three European teams, Portugal, England and Poland. And then 4 years later, we all know about Cameroon getting to the quarterfinals. So I think Algeria lit the paper. They, you know, this is not just a great team in terms of like how they participated at the World Cup, and beating West Germany is fantastic, but also the fact that they were denied the chance to do something else. And I just want to go back to Scott's comments at the beginning as well, because you're right. They did. The Germans were totally arrogant about this. The comments I've read. I mean, they weren't just talking about scoring like 7 or 8 goals. They were dedicating the 7th goal to their wives or their girlfriends, potentially. I mean, if you're similar, I think it was in 2017, there was the Free State Stars player in South Africa who was awarded the man of the match. And, you know, maybe the Germans were the trailblazers here, because when he picked up his man of the match award, he wanted to thank the fans, his wife and his girlfriend, which was fantastic. So maybe the Germans, you know, set the tone that you have to thank everybody. But I mean, Algeria, they were robbed, and
the whole world was robbed. I mean, you're right. Algeria as a team were robbed at that time. But when you reflect, we just recently had a World Cup, and some of the brilliant moments in World Cups. And when you reflect on 1982, for me, it was my first memory as a World Cup. I remember England beating France 3-1. Brian Robson scoring that goal within the first, 30 seconds? And when you reflect on the 1982 World Cup, this game really spoils what was an actually really good World Cup with some unbelievable players. And I know you could say that for every World Cup, that you've got some unbelievable players playing, but you've got Platini, you've got Maradona, you've got Dalglish, you've got Gerezi, you've got there's just some incredible players. Rossi, Zico, Rummenigge. We're talking, and rightly so, about this game, because, and about this Algerian team, because they deserve to be held up there.
Absolutely.
As I said before, because not just because they were playing stylish football for that team for that time, they were and they were so honourable after what happened. But unfortunately, you know, Adair, Socrates, you know, there's so many amazing players at that World Cup.
Another time for that one.
There's not do Brazil 82 right now.
That's fine. But it's not just about Brazil. It's about I'm talking about the amount of amazing players there were in that time, and the amount of things that also came out of that 82 World Cup. I mean, you might remember the German goalkeeper fouling really badly, fouling French. Yeah. Battiston in the semi-final.
It was GBH. It wasn't just
fouling. It was, oh my God, it's probably still one of the worst fouls you ever likely see in a football match. And he didn't get sent off.
No, something that Wayne Hennessy attempted to repeat for Wales in their recent World Cup themselves. To much less effect. He didn't 100% commit in the Schumacher sense of it and just got massively out. Yeah, unbelievably just a bookie. And it does add to that. And I think there was something about that West Germany team who weren't, you know, we come from a nation that has been scarred with our games playing against West Germany. But that, you know, I don't think the narrative around that particular West Germany, that iteration of West Germany, and continuing on with in the semi-final itself, France, this unbelievable footballing side, Germany, a more relentless, ruthless kind of side. Although they had great players. Pierre Lebarski, I thought, was a great little player at that time.
I loved him.
Britain was
one
of the best.
But anyway,
in the world at that time as well.
And then it, you know, Germany getting through then sets up this could be evil battle with Italy in the final, which we'll come to on another pod, I would think. But let's turn our attention.
I mean, we thank God Italy won, because imagine what Germany had won after that. If they'd have won after that game, it was bad enough they went through to the next round and then got to the final. But imagine if they'd have won on the back of that game.
Yeah, no, the absolutely.
God, that's what they're thinking about.
Yeah.
So we need to decide just how great Algeria are, and we are the self-appointed arbiters of this. We will decide. we have five categories of greatness. We have one of the greatest for those right up there. We have true greats for those just above that level. We have touch of greatness. We have edge of greatness. And we have the blinkered greats, those who our own blindness perhaps allow us to put in that category if nobody else in the world does. And then we have a little bonus category, which we've created after last week's pod, the not great, but without them, we wouldn't be where we are today category. So
I'd like to put this team on the edge of greatness, I think, for me. I don't know how you feel about that, you two, because... And I can see you nodding already, but this team are trailblazers in a number of ways for Africa as the nation, as a continent. And they were playing some really stylish football at the time. They beat one of the best, you know, teams in the world at that time. And yes, Germany didn't take the match seriously, and they didn't prepare, as you would have expected. That's their problem, not Algeria's. Algeria beat the team that was in front of them, and they deservedly beat them. They played them off the park that game. And the other thing that we haven't talked about, and I don't know if it's worth talking about it very briefly. I know we're short of time, but this team evolved from the Algerian War of Independence.
Yep.
And again, I don't know if any of you two read some of this, but a lot of the players were thrown together during that period. Yeah, absolutely. And they then molded it as a team and grew as a team. And over a period of what, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, because of that war, and at some stages weren't playing that many, if I remember rightly, weren't playing many other international teams. So, again, to be at that standard that they were in that World Cup for that game against Germany is amazing.
I think the team was primarily homegrown players because I think there was a rule at the time where you couldn't actually leave Algeria until you reached the age of 28.
Correct. Yeah.
So a lot of the players, were home based. So you've got this collective. I'm with you, Scott. I think they are on the edge of greatness. I kind of flirted with the idea of touch of greatness, but I think it's the edge, and I think it's the beginning of something great that's going to happen in world football with African teams participating with their European counterparts. And Algeria have beaten the European champions in this tournament, West Germany. And I completely agree with you, Scott. If West Germany, for all of their failings, didn't take this game seriously, that's a failing on their part. Algeria did. Algeria beat them and were robbed of an opportunity to go further in this tournament. So touch of greatness is where I rank them, which means, Graham, that it doesn't matter what you think.
But we'd love to hear it. We'd love to hear it. Come on, Graham.
This is true. I had them as Edge of Greatness. I think the only bit we hadn't touched on is they've done it on European soil. You know, this tournament is, this true, was back yes, in the day point. When there was, a massive difference between playing them either in Europe or Latin America. And basically, only European teams won in Europe, and other than Brazil, that could win anywhere. And Latin American teams won in Latin America. So, there's a massive advantage, exactly as you say. And if you've grown up playing football in Europe, and that's where you play football all your time, it's a huge advantage at that stage. You didn't have players playing. It was, nowhere near as cosmopolitan as it is now. So, I think that's another bit. I think Edge of Greatness is apt, really, because they got to the edge of it and it was cruelly taken away. But I think Edge of Greatness is where we have to put them. And great story for Algeria. I think as we continue our World Cup theme, and we go to, one of the... I mean, we've started high. We're starting high here. There's a team, when you think about a World Cup great... Brazil 1970, Jamie, they are up there, aren't they?
I mean, it's the influence, the excitement of this team is for so many. But I actually started my you don't need to do much of research on this one because we've seen so much of them. But I did obviously do my research because I'm a professional, clearly. And I started off by searching, why aren't Brazil 1970 a great team? And I couldn't find anything. I couldn't. There's no one out there in the ether that is willing to put their neck on the line and say, actually, Brazil 1970, were they that good? There were some arguments about, they didn't run anywhere near the distances that players run today. The game was played at a slower pace. But
I mean, need to.
Exactly. There's a context to this that the Brazil 1970 team doesn't benefit from all of the modern technology and the preparation that teams have right now. And if they did, they'd still be winning World Cups, in my opinion.
If those players are ageless, oh my God. I mean, it's just watching the footage just made me so excited. Every goal that they scored is amazing. Every goal, there's not one tapping.
Even the ones that don't score are amazing. I mean, Pele is shooting from his own half, not just once a game. he did it in a semi-final against. I mean, the famous one is the one we've probably seen many times against Czechoslovakia in the group stage, where he shoots from the halfway line and it's narrowly, and the keeper scrambling back, absolutely bricking himself. Yeah. But he does it again in the semi-final against Uruguay. From a deep position, he's almost on the edge of his own box and he's like, I fancy this, I'll just have a go. It's just, I mean, the creativity, it's just the, oh God, I mean, I get so excited about this football team.
I hadn't realised, a lot of the memories of this are from those kind of montages that you get, in the warm-up to the World Cup. Back before YouTube, back in, we were preparing for the 82 World Cup, or the 1986 one in particular, which to build you up into tension, BBC, ITV both would put out these. And of course, we remember the last time, and they'd show this footage. Or you'd show montages of Pelé and what he's achieved, these great moments of Pelé. Mm. I didn't realise all these great moments that he's done, the shooting from the halfway line, the unbelievable dummy run past the keeper, and he's just scoring it.
Game against Uruguay.
They're all from the same tournament. They're from this tournament. I can't assume they were from a collection of, this just happens to be televised games. And, we got those memories of things that no other player was doing. No other player was doing them at that kind of thing. I mean, George Best would be the only one who's...
I think it was the whole team, though, Graham. I think you're right about Pelé, obviously. I mean, Pelé was just imperious. But when you look at the goals, and you look at some of the play, some of the passing, some of the long balls over the top. There was one I saw some of the footage I was watching. It was the final against Italy, and I think it was the Carlos Alberto goal. I can't remember if it was the fourth goal or not. But there's one of the Brazilian defenders in his own half. He takes on about three or four players before he then sort of stops. He then stops, and then he plays his ball down the byline, and it was just an incredible pass. The pass in itself was fantastic, and that then led up to the ball coming across, and then and across from Pelé.
The fourth goal is you're right, Clodaldo, who's the defensive midfielder in this team. This team is playing with five number 10s. Yes. They got Gerson, who's a number 10 in midfield, playing against Fernando. Zagallo's playing 4-2-4, which is a wonderful formation. You've got Rivellino and Jairzinho playing out
Rivellino,
Pelé and Tostão.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it is late in the game, and the Italians are tied this fourth goal. But this fourth goal is, for me, one of the best goals I've ever seen in my life. And Scott, you're right. It's Tostão, the number 9, the centre forward, who is run down the touchline, chasing, I can't remember which Italian player it was, on the wing. He's won the ball in the left-back position. This is the number 9 in the 86th minute of a game they're winning 3-1 in the World Cup final. The number 9 is in the left-back position. He plays it in. They play a few little passes. And you've got Clodaldo, who does his chinking. And what I love about that footage as well, the crowd, they get into it. They, when he does that, dropping the shoulder, the feints, you hear the ole, ole. It's like the crowd are like thinking, oh, we thought this was done and now we're getting this. And then he simple pass out to Rivellino, who is playing on the left-hand side, and he plays this beautiful pass down the line, the touchline, into Jairzinho. Now, Jairzinho is playing on the right-hand side, but he's on the left. And what's significant about this goal and what's important is that Fekete, who's the Italian captain, and an attacking left-back, and they played three at the back and kind of wing-backs. Fekete was always an attacking full-back. From the left-hand side. And for this game, he's been told, you go everywhere where Jairzinho's go. Because Jairzinho's scored in every single round to this point. He even scored in the final
round,
this point.
He? So he's
man-marking. So
he scored
absolutely,
in every round, every game. Yeah.
So Jairzinho's been gone right to the left-hand side to receive this ball from the other winger, who's in pretty much the left midfield position, and has created the space on the right-hand side. So he does his little mazy dribble. The defender comes out. I think it's Kira comes out to try and close him down. He can't. He does his little toe poke, which looks to this Pelé. And then Pelé, I mean, look at his frame. He's sorting his feet out, but his body's in rhythm and sync and everything. As he's just adjusting. He knows where Carlos Alberto is. He's just like playing for time.
He's got so much confidence. That's what I loved about it. He had so much confidence that Carlos, he didn't need to look. He knew he was just going to be there, and he just laid on the perfect pass. It was just incredible.
It's fantastic. And also with that goal, when you look at it, the ball's bobbling on that pitch. It's not, Pelé's ball's perfect, but obviously the state of the pitch at the time, it's bobbling. Carlos Alberto. It's just beautiful. It's art.
It is amazing. It is amazing. There's so many beautiful goals in that World Cup.
That goal is so outstanding. And I'm sort of, it's weird. Kenneth Walthamstow's most famous bit of commentary, obviously, for most people, is they think it's all over. It is now. I recognise that, and I recognise quite many people who will be in my side where I say the most famous bit is that exact bit where you say where, and I hadn't realised he was the holding midfielder who beats the three or four players, and that's where he says, they seem to take it in turns to give an exhibition. So that inspired me. Then I thought, you know what? If he's done that piece of commentary, I'm gonna go and watch the second half, and with the original commentary and watch the game. Now, a few confessions around this because I've watched half an hour and it was really interesting in itself. But I got to that fourth goal, and then suddenly. It happened, and he didn't say those words. And I was thinking, I imagine this. And then I realised I was watching the ITV version, which had Hugh Johns, and I couldn't tell the two apart. They all commentators sound exactly the same at that stage.
Yeah. And Hugh Johns was partnered with Bobby Moore at the time. So,
well, this is the bit. This is the bit. I So I then went on a quest because, firstly, my starting point is I think it's Kenneth Wortham's nose, so I'm already wrong. But then I'm still in the, you know, I know there's a bit where you've got 1966 and there's, you've got this unbelievable bit of commentary, iconic piece of commentary from Kenneth Walthamstow. And how would that sound now if you then had Martin Keown in the background saying, yeah, it's a good old thing, get it. You know, it wouldn't be right. You know, it's so, and obviously, you know, there's a period where Martin Keown appeared. And I didn't know where it was. And what I wasn't ready for was 1970. Hugh John's doing the bet, and then suddenly Bobby Moore turns up as the co-commentator. I was then fascinated as to when co-commentators first started. I still don't know the answer. I just can't find that piece of information. Although it has to be possible it was 1970, because that World Cup, obviously, ITV absolutely revolutionised the coverage with their new panels, you know, with Malcolm Allison and Derek Dugan and Paddy Crean, extraordinary stuff. Which it's weird. I don't know if you've seen the James Graham play "Enemies of the State," which is all about the U.S. electoral elections of 1968, where they bring together, a TV news network suddenly hits upon this this opportunity by having Gore Vidal and William Franklin opposing pundits talking about these, you know, which is the first, you know, the first time this kind of thing had happened. And that's repeated. ITV, Jimmy Hill has taken that concept. I was struck by the parallels of it, of having people who argue about stuff on the TV. And it's weird, you know, I don't think it's coincidence that it's come within those 2 years, within that same period. It was absolutely fascinating.
I'm just going to go the extremes is what obviously creates the interest in television. But I think we shouldn't forget that this was the first World Cup televised in colour TV. Before that, I mean, there is footage of World Cups in colour, but they were generally on film and they were made for official films. This is the first one to have a view in public through their television sets where it's in colour. And it looks glorious. It feels glorious. That Brazilian yellow kit against that green pitch, it just... this adds to the levels. So much going on in this World Cup. It's just fantastic. It really is. But it really is.
No, I want to talk about Jairzinho because, Jamie, as you mentioned earlier, he scored in every game. In every game. So I don't know how many times that's all happened six. In the World Cup.
I think it's only happened.
He scored in every game. Every game. He's got seven goals over the total. I don't think it's ever happened before. Cup. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I didn't get a chance to look it up. Mm. So. You know what I was when we were off air and I was talking about David Fairclough. Can you imagine how he must have felt? Because there's a couple of points I've got here. One is I love the camaraderie and the team spirit around this Brazilian team. The way they celebrate every goal is just incredible. You've even got coaches running on the pitch. But poor Jairzinho, he's like bagged seven goals. He's scored in every game, and he must be thinking to himself, "Oh, mate, I'm going to win the golden boot for sure. I must be player in the tournament." Normally, when a striker is that outstanding, he would be player of the tournament. So he must be feeling like I was earlier, a bit like David Fairclough and this super sub. He must be feeling, when they announce that Pelé's the player of the tournament, imagine how he feels. I'm sure it doesn't cross his mind because it was just a beautiful team. But you've almost got to feel a bit sorry for him because Pelé, in all fairness to him, only played a part in 14 of the 19 goals that Brazil scored. what was he doing for the other five?
Put your finger out.
where was he? What a lightweight. So, those two. I mean, I love this team. I love this World Cup. I love this team. And to your point, Graham, you know, the footage that we have seen as we've grown up is generally about Pelé or this 1970 World Cup. And to your point, Jamie, about, you know, the fact that it was the first colour World Cup, the iconic moments it's produced. But this team, oh my God, I just can't stop thinking about them. Now I've sort of spent some time, a bit more time researching and looking at the footage, it's just incredible what level of football they produced in that tournament at the highest level in big matches like the final as well and the semi-final. Every game is just like, oh my God.
Well, just on the back, piggybacking on Scott's point, really. So yeah, they did win all six games. They averaged 3.2 goals per game, the team. Their games actually averaged 4.2 goals per game. So they're averaging a scoreline of 3-1. What's interesting in that run, though, is that their toughest game, I think they would say their toughest game, was in the group stage versus England, where they won 1-0. And I think if, you know, I mean, it's a pivotal game, because if Brazil win that, and I think they go into arguably the easier side of the draw in terms of who they're competing against. England had Italy, West Germany finishing second in the group, and I think Mexico, the host. Brazil in that half of the draw had Uruguay, the Soviet Union, and Peru. I think you could argue Brazil winning that group, that England game, was a key one. But I mean, what's interesting about Pelé, you're right, he was slacky. And I mean, only 14 involvements in 19 goals in the tournament. I think he created something like 28 chances in that World Cup. That's only ever been beaten by Johan Cruyff in 74 with 29 chances. But what I really like, my favourite stat about Pelé in 1970, is that he committed 23 fouls, which I think was one of the most in the tournament by an individual player. And that tells me, well, if you remember, four years previously, he got effectively kicked out of England. He got battered. He absolutely got battered. And he there's famous pictures of him being carried out, you know, on the shoulders of the trainers off, and then Brazil are out of the group, and Pelé's an injured man. I don't know. I like to think he came back, not just this rounded, incredible player that we all love, but he thought, I'm going to, you know, put myself about. I'm going to protect myself a little bit better. And I think that he committed 23 fouls is testament to his adaption in terms of like the World Cup in terms of being the best player. But interestingly as well, I don't think he nearly went. I think there was a time before the World Cup, the coach was Yao Saldana. And he had dropped Pelé and Tostão for a couple of games, and in the warm-up, that was a no-no. So the public were crazy about this. And I think even the government at the time got involved, and they got rid of the coach and they brought in Zagallo, who then obviously went on and won it and was the first of his type at that moment to be the player and a coach to have won, a player winning the World Cup in 58 and a coach in 1970. He was the first to do that. There's so many great things about this Brazilian team.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel, you know, somebody has to play devil's advocate, and somebody has to bring things back to some kind of reality. So, having watched the second half, there's a great moment. It's about 75 minutes in where there's a sort of free kick. Pelé's over it. He's kind of, which he absolutely shanks into the crowd. It's not one you're ever going to see again. There's no James Ward-Prowse about it. It's one of the worst free kicks I've ever seen. And I think,
score at the time?
Yeah, 3-1. They were 3-1 up, I think, at the time. I'll share it out. I mean, it is quite, maybe you're better off having not seen it. And I suppose if you are, Brazil's front five, as you say, unbelievable. I'm not sure Felix, the keeper, was that well regarded at the time. Because there's a great moment where for some insane reason, he punches a really simple ball on his goal line. And Bobby Moore, I think it was, there we go, there's the dodgy keeper again. He's clearly, and you forget now that, you know, in a world where you've got Edison and Alisson, where these, you know, the best keepers in the world are now Brazilian. But for years growing up, you go into World Cups and people were trying to find a weak spot. And it was always the keeper. It was always the keeper. Whether they were, I don't know.
They started changing it in the 90s. And you remember Taffarel and Dida came along. And I think they were consciously wanting to produce quality goalkeepers. And they've now been producing quality goalkeepers for 30, 40 years. But yeah, you're right, Graham, at the time. I mean, they had one clean sheet against England. That was it. Conceded the goal against every
that
other
might have been the reason why they that might have been the reason though that they played total football and they just attacked and they just went forward because what's the best form of defence? It's going forward.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Felix, I think your point is valid, Graham, because you don't really remember the keeper in this team. They probably didn't need a keeper. They could have probably just fielded 10 players and had the goal open. They'd have still won, to be honest with you.
Some may argue they actually did that, Scott.
Well, agreed. So, it's a valid point. Brazil have never, until you know recent history, haven't produced particularly good goalkeepers. But maybe that's the reason why they attack so abundantly, because they knew Felix.
Fascinating
was
as well, watching the footage back, and there's the FIFA, the official film is brilliant because you've got it. It's in Technicolor. I don't know if Technicolor is a real thing, but it's in color. I think it's a Hollywood thing. But they've got this beautiful color going on, but at the end, when the goals are going in, obviously telephoto lenses on for cameras didn't have that reach that they have nowadays, so I love the idea that when a goal goes in, you've got these cameramen that are pretty much on the pitch. They're able to run on the pitch and just crowd players and get their close-up shots. And at the end, you've got this mob that come onto the pitch. And Tostão, bless him, the number nine, he's having his shirt's already gone. And they're wrestling to take his socks off. His boots are gone. He's literally holding onto his shorts with fear, like, you know, this is the last to go and I want to keep these ones. It's just Rivellino passes out because he's crowded by people. It's just like, I mean, it's a different world. I mean, you get pitch invasions nowadays, but yeah, they're generally, you know, one rogue who wants to take a selfie with Ronaldo or Messi.
Yeah, no, I agree. I love, did you see the Italian captain's quote about Pele? I don't know if you ever read it or in your research or not. Benici said he marked Pele during the final, and he was quoted, "I told myself before the game he's made of skin and bones just like everyone else, but I was wrong."
That is good.
I was going to say earlier, that first goal that Pele scores, remember the ball come over the top and he chests it down?
Oh.
No. The header was, this was the first goal against Czechoslovakia.
The ball came over.
Yeah, in the group stage. He chests it down and the chest was immaculate because it, you know, the control was immaculate and it put him in the position in front of the defender. So the defender couldn't get back. But if you watch the footage a couple of times, I've watched the footage a few times on this goal. What actually happens is he's looking like he's going to hit it with his right foot. And then he almost hesitates, waits for the goalkeeper to move and then smashes it in with his left. It was just an amazing bit of skill, really.
It's amazing how he makes it. Yeah. He almost puts the game into slow motion, but it's not. He's in so much control. Right. He's got such quality and he's so far ahead of everyone else. He just makes it look like he's slowed the game down, but he's just that graceful because you're right. The way he shapes his body and gets his feet sorted out, it's rhythm. It's just,
it's incredible, isn't it? Really? And like you say, that the header was a brilliant header. And then he scored that free kick with the outside of his foot. I can't remember.
When he tried it again, he didn't score.
You're nitpicking, Graham. You're really nitpicking now. I can appreciate you trying to play devil's advocate, but the goal he did score, which I think was against Romania in the group stages, was just again a free kick from heaven.
I just noted a little project I'm going to take up. Just a little project, Graham, because you've inspired me, that this free kick that Pele blasts over the bar. I'm going to go through lots of video footage of Pele, and I'm going to create a reel where Pele is shit. And then I'm going to just basically shot after shot after shot of Pele doing something really bad on the pitch. So we could show that actually he wasn't that good after all, really. I mean, look at this.
Well, another argument for Pele being shit. I mean, how the hell did he miss that header against Gordon Banks? I mean, most normal strikers would have scored that.
Absolutely. Bang average. Yeah. Anyway, Graham, you're going to... Graham, you're going to bring us to a close on Brazil 70, and I have a very strong idea where this is going.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point even reading the categories out, really. So fundamentally, are they one of the greatest? Scott, where are you going with that?
You're going to be, listen, I know that you're going to be doing these podcasts for a while. you've started off with one of the greatest teams in history, and you've set the benchmark extremely high. You're going to struggle to find a team that beats this team, to be honest with you. You may have already discovered the ultimate team. I've got no argument in putting them forward as the ultimate. I don't think anyone will have an argument. There's just nothing that you can say. One shot from Pelé going into the stand doesn't detract from this being the ultimate team for me. I mean, at this moment in time, I can't see past it. But then I have been watching the footage for quite some time and started to froth at the mouth.
Jamie, one of the greats for you?
I mean, yeah, I'm pretty clear on this in terms of where I position them. I like to think that this podcast is going to introduce people to a team that they've never heard of, which is Brazil 1970. That would be a nice thing. And that would be good. But I mean, not only were they great, their influence is great, is incredible as well. They were effectively rotating positions 4 years before the Dutch were doing it in 74, and we all love that. They had the false number nine way before Guardiola was playing a false number nine Tostão, you know, basically in the left back position in the 86th minute. Their passing sequences, we've not even touched on that. They were doing combination passing, you know, 9, 10, 11 passing sequences consistently in the game. Mm. And we haven't even talked about the fact that it was a 12 p.m. kickoff in June in Mexico City, the last game of an enduring tournament played in 35 degrees heat. And they still save the best till last. This is, without doubt, one of the greatest teams in history by far.
Yeah,
I concur. I can't do anything to argue against it. Brazil, 1970, truly one of the greatest. So how do you follow one of the greatest, Brazil 1970? The obvious place to go, let's go back to 1958 and look at Wales. Come on, Jamie. How did this come together?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story of great fortune. we'll decide in a minute, or over the next so many minutes, whether they're a great team. But Wales, as we know from the last World Cup that we've just gone through, qualified for their second World Cup. But their first one was in 1958, and it was referenced quite a lot that Wales had qualified only once before for the World Cup finals in 58. The fact is, they actually never really qualified as right. I mean, this is a team of nine lives. This is a cat with nine lives. It's an incredible story. I mean, I'll try to take you through the timeline if I can. So Wales are in, this is a time when there's only 27 teams competing in Europe for effectively nine qualification places to go to Sweden, 16 teams in the World Cup final. West Germany are there as holders, Sweden is there as host. So there's already 11 European teams out of the 16 that are going to be in this World Cup. Wales fail to qualify. They finish second in their group with Czechoslovakia and East Germany. So they're out of the World Cup. That is a fact of when they finish their qualifying stage. And there's lots of crazy stuff that's gone on with the Welsh team in terms of like only sending 10 fit players to an away game in Czechoslovakia for a game, and then having to like, you know, basically dig around some money to effectively get a couple of players shipped out, so at least they've got the bare 11. I mean, this is fantastic. And what we shouldn't forget as well is at the time, probably the greatest player, arguably maybe Gareth Bale now, but the greatest player, John Charles at the time, is in this incredible player for this Welsh team. He's playing at Juve at the time. Juve don't really want to release him for internationals effectively because they want to protect their number one asset. In 58, he was actually voted the player of the season in Serie A. He was top goal scorer, was 28 with Juve. He won the league with them. This is one of the best players of all time. We're talking about John Charles. So this gives Wales a fighting chance just by having this guy in his team. Anyway, Wales have failed to qualify for the 50-year World Cup. Meanwhile, in the African and Asian qualifying section, the two continents were combined at this time in 1958, and there was only basically a handful of teams qualifying. I think there's nine teams qualifying, of which includes Israel, Turkey, and Cyprus from those nine, all of those which go through the European UEFA qualification route now. So, you know, this is not a time when African or Asian football is blossoming. It's just really starting. Anyway, so Israel, I've got a group where they have to play Turkey. Turkey refused to play them. For whatever reason they've chose, political reasons, I believe. And then FIFA decide that, okay, Israel, you get a bye to the next stage, which they are drawn against Indonesia. Indonesia. So I forgot to mention as well. So Asia and Africa has one place to go to the World Cup finals. And this is the place. So Israel are in a good position at the moment. They've gone into the next phase. They're drawn against Indonesia. Now, there's a civil war going on in Indonesia at the time. Indonesia doesn't want to play the game in Indonesia. It's a two-legged affair. So they asked to play at a neutral venue. FIFA then decide, no, you can't play at a neutral venue. We don't really take into consideration what's going on in your country because we're FIFA and that's what we do. I think it was Sir Stanley Rouse at the time was in charge. It was very Eurocentric. So Israel get a bye there. So Israel now in the final round of qualification, having not played a single game. And they're drawn against Sudan. Sudan have come through their qualification against Syria, who they also got a bye into this round. And then Sudan refused to play Israel again. We're back to the same old narrative right now. So FIFA decide, guess what, you know, Israel will get put forward and they will be the representative. But however, 4 years previously, they'd brought in a rule, FIFA, to say that if you haven't played a game, you shouldn't qualify for the World Cup finals. I mean, it sounds
which
pretty
isn't an unreasonable
right?
rule. It's not an unreasonable rule. You should probably have to play someone to qualify.
Absolutely. So as it stands, Israel have the Asian and African place, yet they are being forced to play a game to actually prove their worth. So what FIFA decides to do, they take all the teams that finish second across the whole of the World Cup qualification group. And there's 12 teams, but straight away, Uruguay withdraw. They don't want to be part of it. They failed. They don't want to be part of it. Italy and Northern Ireland are excluded because they refuse to play their final group game because neither of them qualifies. So why would they want the expense of playing this qualification game? So we're down to 9 teams. And out of the hat comes Belgium. So Belgium, Israel. That's the playoff for the final place for the 1958 World Cup. And then Belgium decide, no, we don't want to play that. We don't fancy that. We reject the opportunity. So they go back to the hat and out comes Wales. Wales, Israel. Now that could be the playoff for who gets the final place. And the Welsh, they're not like the Belgians. They're like, we fancy this, boys. We fancy this. So they do go ahead and they play the game. And they beat Israel over 2 legs, 4-0. 2-0 in both games. So they're in the World Cup finals. And the story grows after that as well, but they've made it to the World Cup finals and that's the edge of greatness for them in terms of like where they are. But before I go into the tournament, because there's more to this story, I think it's good for me to take a breath and let you guys come in on some of those facts.
There are so many elements to it. And of course, it's the idea. And of course, we've seen it, you know, many World Cups before. 1958, the teams weren't that fussed about being in it. You know, it's the most extraordinary thing, this pinnacle. You know, by the time you got to 1970, Brazil, it's the pinnacle of world football. It's the biggest thing. But you've got a stage where, firstly, the World Cup's in Sweden. How was the World Cup in Sweden? That's been really quite bizarre. Out of all the footballing nations in Europe at the time, that's, I find slightly bizarre, but even more strange that teams wouldn't see, you know, you can understand the, you know, if you've got political issues, that part coming in, but, you know, that's not about it. We don't want the expense of playing this game.
Yeah.
When the opportunity is to be in the World Cup, it is just unrecognizable from...
Absolutely. I mean, travel distances was a thing back then. You know, getting from one place to another wasn't easy. The 4 teams that were participating at the time, 3 of them came from South America. The other one was Mexico, Central America. So it would have been quite a long airplane journey to Sweden. You're right. I mean, I don't know the history why Sweden got awarded the World Cup, but they did. And they went to the final and lost.
I mean, fortunately, the thing about FIFA giving World Cups to mysterious places, reasons nobody can understand, that's something they got out of their system with Sweden 58. There's been no further issues at any point.
I love that. That's brilliant. That is absolutely gold. Fair play to you, Graham.
So when they got there...
Yes.
What happened to them?
So they're in the group with the host Sweden. They're also with Hungary, who is not the Hungary from 54. It's a different Hungary. And they've got the Mexicans who have traveled the long distance, and they draw all three games in their group. And they finished level on points with Hungary, Sweden top in the group. Hungary had a better record to qualify under what we know now with goals scored. And the head-to-head was a draw, clearly, because they've drawn all their games. But at the time, goals scored was not a thing in how factors were decided at the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So they have to have a playoff. And this is the incredible bit. And this is where for me, Wales do merit their place in greatness, because they've played Sweden in Solna, which is basically north of Stockholm, is part of Stockholm, on the 15th of June, and they've drawn 0-0. They've then played Hungary in a playoff on the 17th of June, and they've won 2-1. And in that game, it's just 2 days later in Stockholm, Solna, their key man, John Charles, the Hungarians have gone for him. He scored against them in the group stage. They know he's a quality player. They've picked him out, and they've gone to town on him and effectively put him out of the tournament. Now, he did try to get fit for the game against Brazil in the quarterfinals. Now, the game against Brazil is less than 48 hours later in Gothenburg, which even today is a 3-hour and 45-minute train journey. So in 1958, you could probably double that, right? So they finished at 7 o'clock on the 17th. They've gone to bed. They've had to get up, travel the whole day on the 18th, get settled to get up on the 19th to play a World Cup quarterfinal against Brazil, who at that time had famously prepared to win this tournament. They had absolutely dotted the I's and crossed the T's. This was a serious Brazil that were coming to Europe to win the World Cup. So they go into this quarterfinal, and Brazil have been based in Gothenburg the whole time. Brazil have gone nowhere. Their last game was 4 days ago. So they've had lots of rest. Wales turn up to this game, having travelled the day before. They've lost their star man, John Charles, and they lose to Brazil, a goal from Pelé in the 66th minute, 1-0. And I think that's incredible. I mean, all of everything that Wales has gone through to get to that Brazilian game, and they narrowly lose is incredible. But I mean, they were incredibly fortunate to get to that point, because there were so many parts of the journey where they should have just dropped out. They shouldn't have been in Sweden. They shouldn't have even been, you know, in a playoff, but they were. They shouldn't have got out of their group, but they did. And they just narrowly incredible, lost to the team that would go on and win the whole thing.
Well, not only that, but they absolutely stuffed France and Sweden in the next two games. They beat them both. They won both games 5-2, didn't they? So, you know, the fact that the hardest game they played in that whole tournament was probably against Wales.
Yeah, it's a brilliant
what if. John Charles would have been fit, it's a brilliant what if. But we don't know.
What I liked about that, when you were talking about goal difference wasn't the thing then. So how do you settle a group? A World Cup group there. I was slightly worried that the solution they had was for Germany and Austria to play each other again as a... So if any group isn't settled, you have to go through the Germany-Austria thing.
Oh, my God. Let's hope we never have to go through anything like that again.
Yes.
The idea of a playoff is crazy.
It is.
It just adds... I mean, there could have been so many playoffs, especially if you take that in... to today's equation. Wow.
As you say, to play those games, and the World Cups are already, you know, a famously kind of insane schedule if you go the whole way through. That, you know, where you're drawn, the places you are have a huge impact, and you can see. So Wales to essentially play three games in five days with, you know, and at least it's Sweden, you know, it's not the biggest country to travel, but it's still a fair chunk. That is absolutely, absolutely crazy. How the legs must have been feeling by that fifth game. And then to have to play Brazil, of all teams, where, you know, that's not one you're going to be able to coast through, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing we haven't touched on for another pod with another team is that the manager at the time for Wales was Ginny Murphy, who, because of that playoff in February of 1958. At the time, Jimmy Murphy was the assistant coach to Sam Abbasby at Manchester United. And because of that playoff, because of Wales the second time out, Wales went to the playoff, Jimmy Murphy went with the national team and didn't go on that fateful flight to Yugoslavia that then obviously had its disaster in Munich on the way back to Manchester. So, I mean, an incredible card there as well. But I think that's for another podcast.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jamie. And it's that going to that playoff probably saved his life. Incredible, really, when you think about it.
Indeed.
So Wales, definitely a fascinating story, but is it a great story? Jamie, are you going to make the case?
I will. I think they're on the edge of greatness. I think they're incredibly fortunate to have got to play Brazil in a World Cup quarterfinal, but against good fortune, lots against them to come so close. You could argue they're a blinkered great. I think a lot of people are quite blinkered about how great they were, but they did have a great player in their time. So I would go just into edge of greatness.
What about you, Scott? Are you going to dispute that, or do you join Jamie in that?
Oh, I think it would. I'm not convinced, but I probably haven't got a good enough argument, in all fairness, to not put them in that category. It's a wonderful story, and you know, you've got to credit Wales for taking their opportunity to firstly get to the World Cup. I love the way that they've, you know, Israel have, so many teams have said no to Israel, but Wales have gone, absolutely, we'll take that, my friends. But then they stopped them twice. 2-0, absolutely, take our chances. So like you said earlier, Jamie, nine lives, fabulous. And they produced, you're absolutely right, they had some really good, they had not just John Charles, they did have some other really good players. Fair play to them to take Brazil all the way, to give Brazil a run for their money with a dynamic 17-year-old Pelé playing for them.
And Garrincha on the other side. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I don't think it deserves to be much higher, but it's a great story. And, you know, there's so many, the spin-off about, the Welsh manager, you know, not getting on the Munich plane is incredible, really, when you think about it. But, yeah, no, I'll support Jamie on that.
I could be dragged into blinkered greatness on this, just to give you a sporting chance.
Well, that was where I was going. I was going blinkered greatness all along. But what tips them into, for me, edge of greatness, it is actually the three games in 5 days. I mean, that is stupid, yeah, isn't it? And so I think that really is that really kicks into the edge of greatness category, because there is something great about that. Just so edge of greatness, I think that's where we go with Wales. We're almost wrapped up, but one last thing we always like to do is to try and think of these teams in the round. And if you had the time machine, if you had the chance this weekend to go and watch one of those teams, where do you go? Scott, where are you going?
Oh, wow.
This is so easy. It's not a question,
but it's, I love the fact that we've got to answer it. Oh, my God. To see Pelé. Just let me go and see Pelé. I'd love to see that team. Wouldn't you want to see that team live? Oh.
Take me in, time machine, Graham.
If that team was there today, you would pay an absolute fortune to watch it.
Well, you pay a lot of money to watch, you pay an absolute fortune to watch certain teams in London at the moment. So, and they had nowhere near.
Yeah,
Pelé.
Sure. I mean, I'd be straight on the play. I'd be, the time machine goes back to 1970 Brazil for me.
I'm hoping I'm near the front of the queue.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, probably just be the three of us. I don't think it fits in anymore.
I don't think I could. I could want to go to Algeria. You couldn't rank Algeria higher. You couldn't rank Wales higher. Would it want to be that Austria Germany game?
No.
Austria Germany,
tissues and hankies at the players.
Beat Brazil 1970. It's not a match. Thank you both. Thank you, Scott. Nice to have you back again.
Pleasure. I'll get my substitute top on for another day.
You'll be Michael Robinson next time.
Or Ronnie Rosenthal.
Oh, Ronnie Rosenthal, exactly. Jamie, good to speak again.
Always.
That's all we got time for. Please get in touch with any comments, additions, corrections about any of the teams we talked about today. If you've got any suggestions for other great teams we should cover, we'd love to hear from you. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll speak again soon.